Time for 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. And I'm Seth Titley-Jones, who will be your host for the next hour. And my first song for you this week is the Poptones. Oh, sorry, Public Image Limited and the Poptones. I only glanced at that and I thought to myself, that sounds like the name of a band, the Poptones, but no, it's the name of a song. Maybe I'm just getting strange and confused and dazed and all the rest of it. Actually, have we had Dazed and Confused? We might have had Dazed and Confused. I don't remember having Dazed and Confused. Surely it's got to be in 1001 Songs. We had A Whole Lot of Love a few weeks ago, if you remember that. But anyway, this is Public Image Limited and Poptones from 1979. If Johnny Rotten, nee Lydon, sounded angry when he fronted the Sex Pistols, that was nothing compared to the bile and spite that spewed forth from Public Image Limited. Already an alienated teen by the end of the Sex Pistols, he was full of disgust at manager Malcolm McLaren and his fellow Pistols, full of sorrow over the fate of Sid Vicious and generally annoyed. He had rushed from P.I.L. and wept out a first album that was little more than a new version of the Sex Pistols' punk sound. For the second album, the band had free rein. Lydon's chief collaborators, Lydon here, just reminding you, is Johnny Rotten. I'm just going to call him Johnny Rotten. It doesn't sound right calling him Lydon, does it? Johnny Rotten's chief collaborators were guitarist Keith Levine and bass player Jar Wobble. The former had a very nasty attack with a spiky guitar, while the latter had no experience whatsoever. With those ingredients, a brace of dub albums and some krautrock and too much cheap speed, cough medicine and marijuana, Public Image Limited set out to make a grand statement. The record grew organically, and it was the nasty edge of cheap drugs, which is amplified by the huge slabs of dub bass from Wobble, punctuated by Levine's noise. This is the sound chalk of chalk being dragged over the blackboard. Very slowly. There are long improvised tunes that are perverse in their refusal to resolve themselves. Johnny Rotten, sticking to his anti-rock stance, falls back into the mix a ghost of his former self. Frankly, his lyrics have really been strong and he was wise to let the soundscape take the spotlight. Poptones has a harrowing example of Levine's misanthropic guitar going out to out of control in a vortex of spindly notes. It was pretty much as anti-show business as it was possible to be. The original album didn't have song titles, and the whole thing was released as a 3 12-inch singles in a film canister. Despite the best efforts of P.I.L., the record became something of an icon against which the post-punk bands measured themselves. Shortly afterwards, the band fell apart to be resuscitated by Johnny Rotten with new players. To his dismay, Public Image Limited did not bring down rock and roll. From Public Image Limited now, we have Poptones.
The smell of rubber on concrete top. Hindsight does me no good. Standing naked in his back of the woods. Let the set play pop tones. We'll be right back.
guidey aunt. Be honest now, did that really work for you? That was the Pop Tones by Public Image Limited. Why do I keep saying the Pop Tones? There is no the on the front of it. Anyway, this is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, as selected by Toby Cresswell and presented by yours truly, Seth Tetley Jones. Of course, when Toby Cresswell made 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, when he wrote the book of it, he didn't really mean to say the great songs of all time and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. He meant to say, well, more or less essentially, completely and utterly and entirely, the songs that I quite like that have been done fairly recently, i.e. over the past 100 years, maybe 200, a couple of them a bit earlier than that, and stuff that I quite like, and stuff that I could think of at the time that I wrote the book. That's basically what his concept really does seem to have evolved to be in here, even though originally he would have thought 1001 Songs was the great songs of all time and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. But never mind. Nevertheless, whatever his particular statement of intention actually was, we have Nene Cherry with Buffalo Stance. Nene Cherry is as eclectic as her heritage. Her mother is Swedish, her father is West African, and her stepfather is the great jazz trumpeter Don Cherry. Nene started her music career as a teenager with the jazz post-punk combo Rip Rig and Panic, and then, in the late 80s, dropped one of the greatest club hits of the era. Buffalo Stance is an eclectic track. He's used the word eclectic twice in two paragraphs, referencing Malcolm McLaren, The Wild Bunch, and Bomb the Bass. But it was one of the masterpieces of the late 80s club era. The lyric is directed specifically at a gigolo attempting to corrupt young women, but is more generally applicable to the macho sensibility. This is an empowerment anthem that seduces with its grooves and melodic hooks. Cherry's rap is right on the money, conscious, tuneful, and masterly syncopated with the music. Production on this track is by Tom Simenon, a.k.a. Bomb the Bass, but the sound is strongly influenced by the Bristol style of the Wild Bunch and Massive Attack, with whom Cherry and her husband Cameron Boogabear McVeigh often recorded. There are touches of reggae and dub in this dense hip-hop mix, that really encompassed. I wonder what her accent is like. If her mother is Swedish and her father is West African, and does she have an accent that's the hybrid of the two? Does she have an accent wherever it was she grew up? Where did she grow up? Doesn't say. I'll just do my normal voice, shall I? It really encompassed a vibe that was around at the time, said Cherry of Buffalo Stance. The whole thing had started to happen, like hip-hop. We're more underground than, say, now. But it was definitely something that people could identify with. And Buffalo Stance was like a song that bridged over that, while at the same time it was a pop record. It also shed a lot of stereotypes that people were bored with. It seemed to make them happy or relieved. And this is Nene Cherry and Buffalo Stance.
Will you sit down and scratching and give me a beat? Ouch! Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce the hi-hat. Go on. That's good. Now the tambourine. Right now. Noise, manhandling toys. That's the girl
Cherry there with Buffalo Stance here on Waiheke Radio 88.3, 107.4 FM, and of course www.waihekeradio.org.nz, where you can also find us with live streaming. I wonder why I said streaming. Streaming doesn't have doesn't have a little sort of false clearing your throat noise at the beginning. Though I don't think anybody really could clear their throat by going, you know, it sounded like more or something like that, which is not really a pleasant noise to have on air. So I think I shall refrain from doing that for the rest of the evening on air. And instead, for your listening pleasure, I have for you Split Ends, and I Got You, which is over the page, which I can't separate. Oh, stupid book. There we go, Split Ends, and I Got You, from 1980. Tim Finn had led Split Ends through 5 years of the storm and tempest of art, rock and pop music. Things were looking grim until his little brother Neil popped out with a very simple pop song that had a slightly menacing melody. This time, Tim and I were living in a house in Sydney in Rose Bay, and we were throwing titles at each other every day, in readiness for recording True Colours, said Neil. He gave me I Got You, and I think he did anyway. I wrote the verse and the chorus actually as it is, but in my mind the chorus was always too corny and I'd have to come back and try and change it and fix it up. Which is probably one of the reasons why it was a smash hit single, because it was so corny. I felt intimidated by its directness, but as soon as the band played it, I realised that I had something very strong about it. But on the day, I remember liking the verse, but thinking the chorus sucked. Split Ends had twisted time signatures into pretzels for some years. Faced with this naive tune, they arranged it as plainly as possible, yet still there's a sense of dark tension in the verses, which is released with the impossibly catchy hook. On the back of this track, Split Ends became a pop band with a twist and went to sell over 1 million albums. The song remains one of the most enduring pop songs of the decade. As for the perfectly paced guitar riff that opens the track, that was the only one I knew how to play at the time, Neil admitted. That was me learning how to play electric guitar. This is Split Ends and I Got You.
Yeah.
That was Split Enz and I Got You, and I am outraged to discover, when I looked in the index of this book, that this is the only Split Enz song out of all 1,001 of them. And I mean, you'd think that, you know, well, I suppose it might have something to do with Toby Cresswell's being a music journalist from Sydney, but I do also think that I wouldn't have had Tony Cresswell down as the type of music journalist that would have known that Split Enz weren't from Australia. They were actually from New Zealand. So I wouldn't have thought he would have, favoured against them. In fact, what do you say when you favour against something? You disfavour it. You prefer. I don't know. I don't know. The opposite of favouring something. I must look that up, actually, the opposite of favouring something, but not now, because right now is David Bowie and Modern Love, here from 1983, off the album Let's Dance. Bowie had at last tasted real success with the unlikely R&B hit Young Americans, which, if you remember, you might remember, what seems like a very long time ago, because it was at the old radio station, Studio 5. We are now in the White House, having moved out of Studio 5, and instead of keeping our LPs, because we have lots of LPs here in what was meant to be a recording studio, we have them in a bath, which is really disconcerting. I mean, I know there's a bathroom here, and we don't really need it as a radio station, because everybody, all the members of the radio, have their own baths to go home to, but I mean, putting records in a bath, what if some small child has the urge to run in there and turn the tap on? Now I say that's probably some small child will run in there and turn the tap on. Why did I say that? I should just get on with reading David Bowie and Young Americans. No, it's not Young Americans. I've already read that. I read that several weeks ago, perhaps months even. I'm reading Modern Love by David Bowie. Here we go. Young Americans, which bled the Philly soul sound. His reaction to pop success had been to retreat to a cocaine haze in Berlin and make a series of groundbreaking avant-rock albums with Brian Eno and Iggy Pop. Bowie was more active as an actor in the early 80s. His musical career seemed, if not stagnant, then going nowhere fast. The thin white Englishman had an innate sense of R&B. His intention was to make a hit album, perhaps out of gratitude to the $20 million EMI had just advanced. Bowie chose Nile Rodgers of Chic as co-producer, and at Mick Jagger's suggestion, Texan guitarist Stevie Ray Vaughan as principal instrumentalist. The combination of Vaughan's aggressive blues style and the heavy, deep funk of Rodgers' Let's Dance gave Let's Dance a unique style. Bowie also had a couple of classic songs up its sleeve. The cynical Modern Love, perhaps inspired by the disaster and fallout from his marriage to Angela, had his best hook since Young Americans. The arrangement had a swing to it, made more powerful by the massive drum sound. It's more of a Niles album than mine, said Bowie of Let's Dance. While that may be true, decision to use the Power Station rhythm section and with the rock styling of Vaughan were directed by Bowie, and the material there was very much his. And the album is global in the best sense. The videos for Two Strikes were shot in Australia, where Bowie's son went to school, and they reflected the political hue, albeit slight, on the album. Rodgers put together the musicians, and the album was cut in 3 short weeks. Bowie briefed the producer, saying, "Niall, I want you to do your best. Make great commercial records." And he did. And this is David Bowie and Modern Love.
Stay in, get things done.
Modern Love by David Bowie, but he said produced by Nile Rodgers, and Bowie reckons that this is more Nile Rodgers' track than his, though Toby Creswell disagrees. Toby Creswell, ladies and gentlemen, wrote 1001 songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, which I, Seth Tetley Jones, am presenting here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Wonder why I said www twice. I don't actually need to say www. I could just say waihekeradio.org.nz and it would amount to the same thing. Just so long as I don't start saying www.waihekeradio.org.nz, because that's never really worked for me. As a, you know, I've just never been able to... It's never really given me satisfaction as a radio broadcaster saying www. It just doesn't seem right. Anyway, that's just my mild compulsion I have against the word, the expression www. Sounds silly, doesn't it? Anyway, moving right along now, we've got Neil Young and Crazy Horse with Cortez the Killer. Cortez the Killer makes little or no sense as a lyric, a meeting between the explorer and the doomed king. Montezuma may have been a metaphor for the 70s superstars living like kings in Southern California, sacrificing virgins to their godlike egos, not knowing what it is about to hit them. Perhaps this is prefiguring of punk, or perhaps it's all another fever dream from Neil Young. It matters little. The song is a three-chord template for some of his most incendiary guitar playing. A power failure during the recording cuts into the song. They missed a whole verse, a whole section. Oh, that's a quote, said Young. You can hear the splice on the tune and the recording when you stop and when we start again. It's a messy edit, but yeah, it's true. It was a total accident. But that's how I see my best art, is one magical accident after another. My guitar, I'm sounding more like Michael Jackson tonight than Neil Young, in my opinion, but maybe that's just me. My guitar improvisations with Crazy Horse are very, very Coltrane-influenced, he said to Nick Kent. I'm particularly taken with the work of Equinox, My Favorite and My Favorite Things. We had My Favorite Things by John Coltrane earlier in 1001 Songs. Actually, I believe. Did we, or did we have a Love Supreme? I think we had both. We had a Love Supreme, or we had one of the movements from... No, they're not movements, they're suites from A Love Supreme. I think it was the one where they go, A Love Supreme, A Love Supreme. But that's by the by as well. Now I've lost my place. Miles! I love just because of his overall attitude towards the concept of creation, which is one of constant change. There's no reason to stay once you've done it. You could stay there for the rest of your life and it would become like a regular job. The Zuma album came as the sky was breaking in Young's life. He had left his second wife and he had finished mourning the loss of his friends. He was back with Crazy Horse, making a huge sound. Zuma was his release and a return to form. As Lou Reed said, summing up Young's career, he's done it once. Cortez the Killer. It was a combination of imagination and knowledge, said Young. What Cortez represented to me is the explorer with two sides, one benevolent, the other utterly ruthless. I mean, look at Columbus. Everybody knows he was less than great, and he wasn't even there first. It always makes me question all these other so-called icons. Neil Young and Crazy Horse with Cortez the Killer. Cortez the Killer by Neil Young and Crazy Horse right here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. From the Beatles' Hey Jude album comes our next track, which is called Rain. Decidedly psychedelic. Rain is a gentle, lazy observation of the outside world that is one of John Lennon's most interesting songs. The track has entered history as the first use of backward tape. Lennon claimed that he discovered the technique while fooling around at home, although the Beatles producer George Martin also takes the credit. In those days, music was recorded onto magnetic tape, which ran through heads on a console. Obviously, spooling the tape in reverse gives a completely different sound. Well, it was a popular technique as the Beatles continued to use it up until the White Album. Ringo was particularly happy with his drum part. Lennon's vocals were recorded slow and then speeded up to give the melancholy and extra trippy feel. Backward vocals tagged onto the back of tracks eventually became de rigueur with death metal bands. Rain and the Revolver album which followed were high points for the Beatles' sonic experiments. Twisting sounds soon became pretentious, gimmicky and meaningless, however. Here they are at the top of their form, and this is the Beatles and Rain.
Yeah.
That was the Beatles with Rain. Here on 1001 Songs, we are ticking closer and closer to the end of another show. But we do have time for Iggy Pop and Lust for Life. David Bowie brought Iggy Pop to Berlin to rescue both of them. Iggy was a chronic drug addict who had been in and out of mental hospitals for some years. David Bowie was a superstar in need of new direction. At Hansa Studios, in the shadow of the Berlin Wall, Bowie, who also had his share of drug problems, left behind his cocaine addiction, his wife, and his previous persona. With a variety of collaborators, including Tony Visconti and Brian Eno, he whipped together some of the seminal albums of his own, as well as two for Iggy. The sound of Berlin was hard, metallic, and compressed. Iggy's first album there, The Idiot, which shows the influence of Bowie's most, was not the sequel to Raw Power, for which the punk crowd had waited. It was dark and obsessional and passionate. The second Iggy Pop album was done very quickly, in the same year as The Idiot. Inspiration was running low, and Bowie would ask Iggy for his favourite Rolling Stones song. Iggy would pick one, which Bowie then rearranged and created a new tune for, and then Iggy added lyrics. They went through a dozen classic artists and styles. Iggy's best-known song is the title track. Bowie wrote the riff, which is carried by the drums and bass on the ukulele. It works quite well when you can see the commas, but it sounds a little bit counterintuitive when you read it out. It was based on the theme for American Armed Forces Radio in Germany. Iggy's added lyrics that were essentially a happier update from the world's most forgotten boy. Lust for Life was a statement of purpose. There's two ways with David, Iggy told Barry Hoskins. One contribution he makes is sort of conceptual and even gets to the point where he writes some of the lyrics himself. He collaborates on the lyrics with me, not on all the tracks, but on some of them. He'll even give me a concept for a title, Lust for Life, for example. For that, he had a chord progression which was written on the ukulele in the TV room, and I've always had been in the habit of watching my instrumentalists and seeing if they get that gleam in their eye, and if they do, then I'm off like a shot to get the tape recorder. I wasn't even supposed to be a song, but he saw me there with his eyes on him like, come on, fucker, pull it out. The song was not popular when it appeared and didn't really break through until the 90s, which is when it was used magnificently in the opening sequence of the film Trainspotting, an update of the Bo Diddley beat. It got sprung energy, and it really just sits with the beats and the voice. Pop's lyric appears to refer to himself, and it's both cocky and amusing and confident in ways that his band, The Stooges, never were. And this is Iggy Pop with Lust for Life.
million in prizes. We have a torture film, Jabba GTO. We're a uniform, a line of government loan. I'm worth a million in prizes. Yeah, I'm through with sleeping on the sidewalk. No more beating my brains. No more beating my brains. With liquor and drugs. With liquor and drugs. Well, I'm just a modern guy. Of course, I had it in the ear before. And I was lost for life.
That was Iggy Pop and Lust for Life, co-written, of course, by David Bowie. This was 1001 Songs for Another Week with me, your host, Seth Titley-Jones. I will, of course, be back next Monday night at 8 p.m. And, of course, this show will be repeated on Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m.